Yeah, I did my bachelor's in the US and then years later I went to South Africa to do my master's. Maybe it's not so directly. I had lived in Uganda for 2 years before that. And I mean, I think that's where the idea came to continue my education in South Africa. But that, for me, that was really important. 2 years of, going to another context, a third context. That's not the US, not the West, it's not Palestine, but it's a, post-colonial place that was very different for me, very, yeah, very different, but it was incredible to see, to kind of like see that world, like it's kind of like this place with its national narrative, with its history, with its culture, with its pride, with its music, etc. And there was a lot of parallels also, seeing how, neocolonial strategies were being put in place, development, how international policy was being influenced by the quote unquote greater powers in the world. And seeing how people were responding, and for me it was really refreshing that, it was a third context for me that I felt really like welcomed. But yeah, so that's what made me decide to not continue my education in the West. Maybe naively thinking like, I'm gonna find something different in South Africa, but the West is really strong in South Africa also, especially in Cape Town. So yeah, it was a very difficult year for me. It was, full of things, amazing people. But I think, coming from a Palestinian context to a post-liberation, post-apartheid South Africa, I think it has a lot of latent, hopes maybe, or to see what's on the other side of liberation. So there's like these categorizations of time that are really interesting, that have assumptions of the post and the pre and the ongoing, So it ruptured a lot of things because it, South Africa is deeply like complex place, a place that's unresolved, place that has a lot of hardship as well. And yeah, it's not a complete liberation, and there's a lot of mutations of how things kind of, under the veil of post-apartheid or liberation, get mutated and turned into other forms of power and oppression, that are perhaps more privatized, economic. But the basic power dynamics is the same in so many ways. And I don't want to simplify. I don't want to reduce things, but that was the feeling. And in speaking with people there, that's what my friends were sharing with me. So it was hard not to think like, okay, this is what coming our way, in the post-apartheid Palestine, where you have a subservient class that's working for the colonizer, where land is owned by a minority that, you know, came as settlers, where, yeah, the power of capital, money, becomes the new tool of, you know, land occupation and dispossession. And yeah, and where like a black elite also becomes a, or always has been, you know, an issue. I don't know. I mean, South Africa was very important in my life, really important. I think I met the best people I know there. And it was a place, like sort of a mirror, holding a mirror onto yourself of like a similar human experience. So you don't need to explain a lot to a South African. You know, they kind of like, they get it. But at the same time, you end up seeing yourself through their experience and through letting go of your own struggle for a moment and like understanding, you know, their history, their cause, their very different context. And I think that's true to like a lot of places where there's oppression. And that's actually empowering, you know, for Palestinians like that are so isolated sometimes, you know, it's to see like, you know, unfortunately, the world is full of tragic situations, you know. And, you know, we're not alone in fighting that and in demanding a better situation in life. And, you know, like the apartheid regime in white South Africa was like in bed with the Zionist regime. They were like relying on each other, actually, like to a crazy, unbelievable dependence on each other. You know, like jeeps, military jeeps that were produced in kibbutz in Israel were, you know, surveilling townships in South Africa. Israeli weapons were really important for the South African regime. Diplomatically, they were supporting them. And vice versa. And so, you know, it's like if the colonial power structures are meeting and are kind of conspiring on and learning from each other on a singular plan, you know. You know, similar how, you know, Nazi Germany learned from the US how to manage the natives and, you know, all the kind of concepts of a concentration camp. You know, it's like sort of also circulating knowledge and know-how. And so it becomes like, okay, how do we counter that? How does the peripheries meet, you know? And what story can we tell together, you know? A global story, of like a trans-local that's made from trans-local knowledge and experience. And that's, for me, is really, really interesting, really powerful. Let me try to answer that. I mean... I was doing my master's thesis in South Africa. So that's also something that really influenced the way I think and the way I think of the politics of land in settler colonial settings, you know? And so I'm a person that really moves a lot. And I lived in the US, I lived in South Africa, I lived in Uganda. And Aziza has always been the place I come back to. You know, she's this really stationary anchor. And I would come back and I would tell her a lot of my stories and my adventures and, you know, my insights. So that's always been kind of this contrast of somebody that's moving a lot versus somebody that's always there. But yeah, for the last 4 years, I've been there. Yeah, I mean, this is sort of Aziz's character, you know. She's always curious. She's always asking questions. She doesn't take anything for granted, you know. And I think, you know, this is my maybe hypothesis. I can't say for sure, but I think there's something about, you know, being a farmer, having always to respond to the world around you, having always to observe, to take in things, and not to fall into judgment, that is actually makes for a very open-mindedness in a way. Yeah, I mean, you're mentioning about climate change, and you know, she has that sense also of like how things are changing climactically. So that was very interesting also in the beginning phases, to see her as a witness to a lot of these changes beyond the political and social changes, but also climactic changes as well. Yeah. Yeah, I don't want to single out olives, you know? Like, I feel like, you know, they have this political symbology, but it's the Palestinian grove used to be diverse. It has to, like Aziz's. Aziz's is the real one, you know? It's like you have 16 types of trees. One time I asked her, you know, like, which one do you like the most? She's like, all of them. You know, she's not romantic about it, you know. This is, you know, there's not the romanticism about it. There is a story, though, of that's really amazing, actually. Like, she planted an olive tree 20 years ago, and she called it Aziz, you know. And, yeah, this is another character in the film. And I should say also, Aziza in Arabic means like what is most cherished. So in Arabic, Bi'ard Aziza translates in the most cherished land. But it also translates in the land of Aziza, you know. So there's a play in words that doesn't translate in English, and perhaps I'm going to change the name in English of the project, but there's this thing about the word, the name of Aziza, like its root is coming from Iz, which is it's a concept I'm still trying to understand, you know. But, you know, she would say something like, if, you know, an agricultural land is abandoned, she'll say, you know, the Iz left this land. Or if someone comes and takes care of something, the Iz arrived to that land. So I'm also grappling with what is Iz, but it's also related to al-Aziz, is something that you cherish. And I wanted to say also, you know, something really important for this project is like, it comes from that, from the early beginnings of the urban and thinking of place, and a really amazing author and Hussein Barghouti, you know, talks about the etymology of the word place in Arabic, means makan, and the way Arabic works is this root structure of words. So, you know, words are kind of read as like a family of concepts rather than singular definitions. And so makan is related to makan, which means to remain, but it's also related to a word imkaniyya, which means a capability, and tamakkun, which means mastery. And it's also related to the word كان to be كون universe كائن species of life all the species of life and so like it's so full you know like it's like English a bit flat you know place but when you think of that word in Arabic and you go back to those roots you start thinking of you know there's a sort of a meaning behind it there's a, like a deep sense of like how do you have a capability of living in a place and a mastery of living with all the knowledge of the plants and the animals and the weather and the, and that's how you can be and it's also related to the word kayan which is like you're like a deep sense of identity so that's been really like a guiding thought for the film. Yeah, at this stage of the process, I'm like really like trying to understand the visual language that I'm using. You know, it's really like I'm experimenting with things and seeing what's important. But yeah, the qasr, or it's called mintar. You know, it's a common kind of like architectural feature in the Palestinian highlands, in the Ramallah area, but also in Hebron and other places. And they're kind of like temporary abodes, temporary places where people stay during harvest. And the harvest of figs is a long process because the fruiting period is long. So the families would, you know, move from the town and kind of occupy this mintar. And you have to really pick the fig right before it's not too ripe or, you know, just right time. And then you place it on, you know, on a surface and you let it dry. And the word mintar means like to watch over, you know, so it's to watch over the figs so they don't get stolen, you know. And you wait for them to dry. And but in that process, people are living away from their towns. Sometimes it's not so far, you know, a few kilometers away. But yeah, this was a really important memory for Aziza. She always goes back to that, you know. It's also interesting for me to see what is the most cherished memory, you know, that you go back to like a safe place in your imagination of like a time when things were, you know, like she says, like full of life and love and kind of thing. So I grew up hearing about this thing of the harvest and the whole family is going to the valley and the night being full of stars and, you know, the different families singing across the valley to each other and kind of hearing these echoes of al-rababe, which is a string instrument, and these songs and making bread and this kind of like simple life of when the water was still fresh and you can do that. Yeah, and of course, like that's something that's quickly disappearing. So I don't know. I mean, it's also like how do you take that culture forward? Not necessarily going back to that. But, you know, how do you evolve it and contribute to it and change it and, you know, but kind of keep the things that we like and that are good, you know. So, yeah. Yeah. I mean, they've been there 12 years now, you know. I don't know, they're struggling, you know. I think, you know, it's also we're starting to, you know, we're coming from a relatively privileged situation, you know. We have American passports, economically we're fine. But I think lately, you know, like the struggling, you know, they left, my parents left because of my brother. You know, he has special needs and they needed better healthcare. You know, this was, I wouldn't say the full reason, but I'd say 80% of why they decided to go. But yeah, I feel like they're really struggling with the climate. No, with the political climate there and life in general. And, you know, my brother was there also. My younger brother has been there for 13 years. And he's just had it, you know. He's done. So he's coming here in a few days. And he wants to go back to Palestine in this time. Which is, yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's crazy, you know. So it's also my own struggle. It's like it's so hard to find stability there. You know, if you have the means to leave, you have a passport or some way, so many people are thinking of leaving, you know, also. It's hard to find stability. It's hard to project into the future, you know. And I guess I'm at that age of like, I want that. I want stability. And the fact that my parents are abroad and it's also kind of playing into that tension of do I go, do I stay? But yeah, my grandparents are not moving, you know, so they're there to stay. So that's also a bit, you know, of a concern for the family. Like, you know, people in old age are very fragile. I think also me being there was very important for the rest of the family, that they know that there's somebody there in case, you know, someone got ill. I could take them to the hospital. I can, you know, be there. You know, the latest rounds, you know, I was calling my grandmother and she's like, it's terrifying, you know, the bombs and the rockets and the, and just generally like the instability, any moment, you know, they can, So it's a strange feeling, you know. It's a really painful, actually, feeling that your homeland becomes a site of pain and trauma, and you know, and sometimes you associate it with that, you know, like you're going back to a place that's like. I'm hearing it from a lot of people. It's hard to go back also. Although this is like a privilege to be able to move, you know. But yeah, I mean, sometimes I think, you know, we were a big family there. How things would have been like. And Palestine's amazing, like amazing weather. Mediterranean, 1 hour you're in, half an hour you're in the Mediterranean, half an hour you're in the desert, half an hour you're in the mountain. It's gorgeous, you know. You know, I hope, I wish, you know, we can live there, you know. Why projecting ourselves and trying to make a life in the US or Europe or, you know, I think... Yeah, exile is difficult, you know, it's difficult to be away for that long, you know. But yeah, I think a lot. Every Palestinian family has a story like that. Yeah.